You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello everyone, welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. This, surprisingly enough, is Matthew Raphael Johnson, and it is the 3rd of August, 2022. Now, this is recorded a bit before that date, so at the moment I don't have tons of information on the Taiwan situation, but this proves beyond question that the U.S. is overtly looking for a war, and the strategy being, even if the U.S., of course, is going to lose, but it doesn't matter. So long as sufficient damage is done to the enemy, what they consider their enemy, countries that are more doing better than the U.S., which is a lot of countries, and if they're destroyed sufficiently, that the U.S. can... while, of course, being bloodied, reassert its dominance, that's a victory. This is why nuclear weapons, for the first time since 1945, are an option. And this is official military doctrine. This isn't, the doctrine of the regime. The military itself is not on board with this kind of thing. So I usually don't make statements like this, but you're talking about a psychotic ruling class, and this is proof beyond any question. Anyway, we'll do that some other time. Remember, the website theorthodoxnationalist.wordpress.com. My merchandising link is on there. We have some new things: the white, straight, nationalist, and proud that my wife helped to design, and certainly she's in charge of that page. And straight donations, either via Patreon or my regular donate button, which is also, you can find that pretty much anywhere. So today I want to go back to the basics of everything that we do here. And that's the concept of the Russian nationalist movement and its identity, specifically in the middle of the 19th century. In the famous debate between so-called Westernizers and Slavophile. It was the Slavophiles that first got me into this field in terms of political theory. I was already a historian of Russia's comparative entity. So, the Slavophiles are wildly misunderstood. They're conflated with other movements, and they use a vocabulary that most Westerners can't really translate. The translators... from Russian to English also don't have the understanding of what this movement was about. And even in translation, it can be very difficult to translate the idea from a very different civilization to English. So, as always, you can't talk about a political movement without talking about their era. Political movements don't come out of nowhere. You can't understand the arguments that they made unless you understand why they make them. And why they make them has to do with the time period in which they're living. In the middle of the 19th century, roughly around the time and a bit after the reign of Nicholas I, the Decembrist movement, and then Alexander afterwards, is the context for all this. And as I've said before, if the Petrian era was the thesis, the Slavophiles the antithesis, then the royalist movement in the 20th century is the combination of both, or the synthesis. Of course, I'm not being Hegelian there. Hegel didn't use that kind of terminology. But it was this confrontation in terms of the identity, what the Russian ruling idea was going to be. That's where these ideas came from. Nicholas I was the emperor at the time of most of the writing of the Slavophile movement. This is the best expression of Russian nationalism at the time. And this is also at a time where Russia is reclaiming some of its old identity. You know, had the Old Believer movement, for example, not come into existence, a lot of the old Russian traditions in terms of literature and liturgy would have been destroyed. And they were going to a fully Latinized set of institutions. And the only ones who maintained it were the Old Believers for a very long time, especially outside of the cities, because they had a majority of the population behind them, actually a huge majority behind them. The official church was not able to go very far. And there was nothing that the new right didn't try to unearth. So, but that was checked in this era. The ideology of Nicholas I, to some extent Alexander II, and Alexander III, not to mention Tsar Nicholas II, of course, is the last one. This whole era is about balancing those two struggles. The combination of what you can get from the late 17th and the first half of the 18th century, and then the Old Believer movement, which of course was consistent throughout. The Slavophiles wrote mostly under Tsar Nicholas. We'll be talking about your typical list of Slavophiles, the Kirivsky, Komiakov, and St. Makarius of Optima. All writing roughly around the same time. So modern, it's your normal group that at least the literature is right about as far as that goes. They know the name, and that's about where it ends. So Tsar Nicholas saw himself as a bridge between the Petrian era on the one hand and traditional Old Believer Russia on the other. Unfortunately, he was involved in persecuting the Old Believers, but this is also the era of the Edinoverie, or the sort of the Unia for the old belief. But no matter what era in Russian history you're talking about, the monarch saw himself as a father figure, basing his sense of self on the family, the state in the true sense of the term, not just institutions, but the state as constitution is an extension, an outgrowth of the family. The family, it can't be denied, is the one absolutely natural, universal institution. There is no civilization, except maybe this one, that doesn't take it as absolutely normative and then uses that as a metaphor for every other social grouping, especially the nation. But monarchy in particular, regardless of its ethnic context, makes sense because, like certain forms of judgeships, the law can be manipulated. The law, you can find loopholes. If you're powerful enough, you can manipulate language. You know, the courts can manipulate it. Bureaucracies can manipulate it. And only the powerful will be able to find the loopholes or simply get away with not obeying. In other words, the laws are really for the poor and the middle class. This is why the monarchy in Nicholas's mind had to be above the law. The law is relative. The law is based on words and present and ever-changing definitions. Not to mention judges. I mean, there's no such thing as a rule of law. There's always going to be an individual. But the monarchy, not just in Russia, had a tradition of lifting or suspending laws in cases of emergency to show mercy. Usually debts were wiped out when a new czar was elected or came to power. Interest rates were kept low because of the strength of the currency. All of this has to do with the strength of the monarchy. For him, the hierarchy socially is, you know, the family at the root, and then the parish / school just above it. The parish had a lot of social functions, as did the monasteries, although Peter took a bite out of that. And these institutions are essential because men are weak. You can't count on people to do the right thing, even if they want to. in many cases. Liberal democracy is the process of vote buying, of convincing people with misleading slogans that to vote for me means change in policy or a maintenance of the same policy. Assuming, of course, that politicians have any connection to policy at all. And it empowers, in this case, a large bureaucracy that represents nobody. In the Russian case, there was a connection between the noble classes, which were, you know, growing superfluous, on the one hand, and the bureaucracies on the other. And they would often team up against the monarch. Remember, the Russian state was very small up until the revolution. The number of bureaucrats relative to the size of the country were minuscule. Police powers in St. Petersburg were minor compared with, for example, London or Paris. There were more bureaucrats in the city of Paris alone than in the entire Russian Empire by the time of Tsar Nicholas II. And yet, all we hear about is the sheer number of bureaucrats. Because the bureaucracy was almost by definition a part of the nobility, although they had separate agendas, they often could resist and successfully resisted laws that were passed by the emperor or the Senate himself. But liberalism is no solution because it empowers the same group of people just on a different basis. The nobility and the bureaucracy were seen by Tsar Nicholas as extremely suspect. And Nicholas was always complaining about the fact that his will was never being followed through because of these layers that stood between him and the common population. So he decreed things along the lines of a special police unit that existed only to police the upper reaches of the nobility. And for example, the state bought food and made it available when times were rough at a very or below market price pretty much all the time. Nicholas had the power to free the state serfs. Of course, it was his successor, Alexander II, that freed the relatively small number left over. And he called, Nicholas called nine commissions to lay out the legal foundation for what Alexander II took credit for. The legal foundation was created by Nicholas I. He was opposed to serfdom. State serfs are one thing. He had far more power over them than he did serfs attached to the land, which are owned by private peoples. And so Nicholas, for some reason, and I think it's largely because of his view on the Jews, his view on currency and his view on the nobility, has been condemned in the West as some sort of a tyrant. Well, the only tyranny that any of them, any of us, live under is the one we live under right this second. But even the Decembrists, this group of the upper reaches of the nobility that didn't want Nicholas to come to power, that wanted a monarch who, well, in this case, his brother Constantine, who they thought they can control, and they tried to force Constantine on the state, and they failed. That doesn't mean, though, that Nicholas didn't examine their grievances, legitimate or otherwise. That wouldn't have been the case if the reverse were true. The state, to those with money, those with power, is simply an instrument for them to gain more of that. Thanks to his tariffs and closed borders, Russia did very well financially. They were exploding in terms of industry. You know, the Crimean War caused tremendous dislocation. The Crimean War is one of these factors that built up this battle between the Slavophiles on the one hand and the Decembrists on the other. But the industrialization of Russia is one of these crises, these turning points. The railroads were exploding all over the place, so connecting regions that weren't connected before. The consumer society, international trade, because of the strength, the ruble never knew greater strength than under the monarchy, especially in this era. And because of that, they were able to buy pounds and francs and increase the volume of international trade to Russia's interest. And that's only, though, when the nobility was able to actually listen to what the Tsar had to say. That wasn't always the case. And this is why Nicholas tended to appoint military men to these positions rather than nobles or career bureaucrats. You know, the career bureaucracy, as we know from Gogol and Dostoevsky's writings, had a ranking system, and they had uniforms that were parallel to the military ones. So you could rise up in state service and become, a colonel or something like that. Not military, but purely in the civilian realm. So it wasn't difficult for Nicholas to appoint military men who he thought were more efficient and didn't have the self-interest of the noble classes. There was no question that Russia was doing extremely well, but because of the growth in the state, the growth of railroads, the growth of industry, the huge turnover of international trade affecting Russia for the first time in a long time, this is what specifically caused the crisis in identity. But anyone who wants to talk about freeing serfs, you look to Nicholas. And the Slavophiles, too, were opposed to it. Nicholas is the one who got this started. He died before he was able to finish it, but it was finished by Alexander. So this is the context of the Slavophile movement. And it doesn't really have a analog in the West. Possibly the agrarians are about as close as we can get. But the entire cultural phenomenon, especially the religious phenomenon within which they lived, the milieu in which they lived, gave birth to a movement that doesn't have analogs elsewhere. And the reason for this is that they were medievalists in the sense that they realized that the internal life, especially of those with power, is far more significant than the laws considered in the abstract. The moral standing of individuals and what controls them internally isn't stressed in the West as much as it is in the East, and of course this has everything to do with orthodoxy and the idea of eldership. I'm going to talk about Makari of Optima as a Slavophile in a little bit. That power is not it's not something to be searched for. One of the things about monarchy is that if it is hereditary, it means that those born into it never actually pursued it and have no need to pursue it. In other words, the last people that you should ever put in power are those that are seeking power, which is, of course, all politicians care about. And they'll say what they have to say. It's a burden, not a right or a privilege. Therefore, humility and the initial rejection of power is necessary. The interior life, the formalism of the Westernizers, the idea that of utility or even their bogus natural rights system that developed in a secular environment were completely rejected. There is no society without consensus, and consensus is bought by and created by the similarities in language and religion. Things like, love, empathy, humility. Law has nothing to do with engendering those. Law can't generate internally reasons to abide by it. That's completely outside of the domain of law, which again is something in the West that doesn't, I guess the closest the West comes is intention in terms of criminal law, the knowledge that you have to have in contract law. But none of this implies any kind of virtue. Virtue is almost implied in the entire system. But because the law and the state has no connection to these interior states, virtue or vice, it gets forgotten. I've said 100 times that liberalism fails because it corrodes the very virtues that are necessary to live under it. Liberalism implies, in terms of the American founding fathers, pretty much everyone in that era said there was only a religious and moral people that could live under this constitution. Liberalism is parasitic on virtues that the more ancient systems helped engender. Law has nothing to do. Law cannot generate the virtues required to obey it and understand what the law means. The only thing law can do, especially in the Western sense, is punish people for disobeying it. And that may or may not increase the commonwealth. But all the things with empathy and love, these are things that can only be engendered by a social body. There has to be an underlying cultural world, but in a religious world, that creates it, and the state, of course, can take advantage of that. Only, you know, the written law, the formal sense, the positivist sense of law, exists only in oligarchies, only in societies that have sharp divisions between property owners and the proletariat. The very existence of a proletariat shows how alienated the formal laws are from the day-to-day life of the population. They're not made by the ordinary person, for better or for worse. Aksakov, one of the greater earlier Slavophiles, made the point that one of the important, maybe even the most important aspect of the Russian idea is that there is no legitimacy, there is no virtue without a voluntary and common consent. Laws don't create consensus. Laws presuppose consensus. If that's not the case, then law ends up looking like this alien imposition on everybody. Now, the way they tended to, especially Aksakov, they opposed what they call the land. The land is essentially the common population, you know, guild members and mostly peasants, because Russian was overwhelmingly a peasant society. In America, of course, our peasants have been almost completely destroyed. It's never called them peasants. And then the state. Now, you have to be very careful in defining these terms. By state, they're referring to formal institutions, you know, courts, legislatures, even the crown itself, seen only as formal things, prohibitions, fines, prison terms. Russia does not have a long history of prisons, by the way. So the state are the formalized institutions of rule and power. The land is the opposite. It's the virtue of the peasant population that's necessary for any law to function whatsoever. You know, old Russia didn't see any central control over the local levels. Ivan IV, and then after the time of troubles after him, started to create and rebuild this. Otherwise, old Russia didn't see any federal power to be found in local government at any point. So, talking about the nature of the land versus the state, political liberty, or I should say political freedom, has nothing to do with the land. Political freedom, on the one hand, does not equal liberty, because liberty implies virtue. It implies a well-rounded person that was born and raised through these more or less informal institutions, including the extended family. Even something like contract. The idea of a contract can only exist with a proper virtuous disposition. Otherwise, there, like all other aspects of law, you're going to be looking for every possible... I mean, if utility is all you care about, and profit's all you care about, then that's all you're going to worry about when you sign these things. Especially if there's a differential in power between one side or the other, contracts may just be a way to justify exploitation. A labor contract is, it wasn't the case back then, but a labor contract is one between a huge corporation, more powerful than the state itself, often, and the isolated individual. Who's going to win that fight? Clearly, they are so different. One is so much more powerful than another, you could hardly even talk about a contract. It's not entirely voluntary. You know, most Americans, the fact is, don't like their jobs. There's actually quite a bit of literature on those. But liberty and freedom are two completely different things. I just published something on Patreon about that. But when they, Aksakov and others, when they talked about virtue, they meant specifically, and this really almost is the summation of all the virtues, self-sacrifice. It's like being in a marriage, and it's not an accident that Christ referred to his church as a marriage. He and the monarchy did the same thing. There is actually a ritual in the Russian coronation where he, quote, marries the realm. It's actually a medieval and even an older inception of political rule, the family is always at the foundation. How you would behave as a father of the family is the same way you would behave in any position of power. But fatherhood isn't based on a written constitution. Fatherhood isn't based on formalities. It's the very opposite of that. Well, if a virtuous father doesn't need a set of written laws to wisely oversee his extended family, then the state doesn't either. Because ultimately they're not different. In liberalism, the exact opposite is true. There is really no such thing as a family. It's recognized in law, but it's not the foundation of law. So things like Pugachev's rebellion, this was the old believer rebellion against Catherine II. Now the Slavophiles always thought that Catherine was illegitimate, as do I. The second, that is, so-called the Great. Pugachev was the expression of the land. This was a Cossack old believer uprising against Catherine. The secularization of church lands, the empowering of the nobility, and the creation of what we call serfdom in the worst sense. Previously, it was not serfdom. These were tenant farmers. Tenant farmers and serfs are two different things. Serfdom isn't slavery, but it's very hard to get out from under this because Catherine needed and depended on a small faction of the upper levels of the nobility to function at all. She was not a Russian woman. She spoke Russian with a heavy German accent. She converted to Orthodoxy only because that's what you have to be to rule Russia. She was an alien. And her policies showed that. And I have so many talks and articles on her in that entire 18th century that you could refer to those as far as the details are concerned. Therefore, an uprising against her, as violent as Pugachev was something that was a matter of necessity. Now, one of the things that the land, those like Pugachev and so many others, Bolotnikov, one of the things that the land represents is the nation. The land also refers to ethnicity. And it's not crazy, as I've done many times, to oppose the state on the one hand to the ethnicity on the other. Ethnicity is not a matter of formal institutions. The same thing goes, you see, in Leontiev, the distinction between culture and civilization. Civilization is not a good thing. It comes into existence only when the culture breaks down. When the culture breaks down, that gives room for the state and private capital to take over, serving, of course, solely their own interest. So on the other hand, if ethnic institutions and ways of thinking are strong, and of course that's religious by definition, then these other less friendly centers of power can't function the way they would like. That's why the regime always takes advantage of crises, even artificially creates crises, for the sake of breaking down these social bonds. And war is one of those things. War breaks down all moral bonds of one person to another. And I've talked about that at great length. Thucydides and many others in the ancient world wrote on this. The nation is the universal truth of natural law and God's law, manifest in a specific time and place. And they're going to be different from one another, in many cases substantially. That doesn't mean that the universal truth is violated in any way. It's just manifested differently. There is no ethnicity without natural law. There's too many commonalities among ethnicities to suggest that there's really any other cause for it. Now, the Western idea, of course, negated all of these things. People make the really silly argument that the French Revolution created national. Well, they created the civic state. It actually was a war with the nation in terms of ethnicity. The battle between ethnicity and the state, and again, I also mean private capital when I refer to the state, because today they're pretty much the same thing. The ethnicity is informal. The state is formal. The state goes by the letter of the law. Ethnicity creates the content, creates the consensus and the virtue required to take the law seriously in the first place. Otherwise, everything has to be imposed by force. That's the other option. Tsar Nicholas and his successors were aware of it. And they were aware that without the veneration coming from the church and the nature of the Russian ethnos, or the super ethnos, the law is not something that's going to be followed. And St. Petersburg had a tough enough time making itself heard. And of course, the story, one that Nicholas and pretty much everyone in that era, a ruler in that era would have understood, is that the Westernizers were a threat because they were breaking down not so much the state system, but they were breaking down the informal sectors, the culture, the land, the people, in the true sense of the term, that made law worth following. You cannot have a society that functions entirely by force, but that's what liberalism has become. The American Constitution is a very aristocratic document. Voting was a privilege that came from being in a very specific position, both in terms of your education, historical knowledge, and economic circumstances. Claiming that the proletariat has a right to vote doesn't even make sense. The problem with factions, you talk about, you know, George Washington and John Adams, their condemnation of factions, had nothing to do with mob rule as such. But they were aware that one faction of the nobility, one faction of the wealthy, were going to use this dissatisfaction for their own purposes. And make it seem like it's a mass movement when, in fact, they pull the strings. That's what a faction really is. John Adams, the second president, one of the great defenders of the Constitution, in its true sense, realized this is what the French Revolution was, and he wrote substantially against it. It had nothing to do with ethnicity. Using a very estranged definition of nation to refer to formal institutions is to deliberately obfuscate the entire issue. The Western positivist and liberal idea, it seems to be a self-fulfilling matter. They slowly chip at the idea of ethnicity and religion in the family, hence bringing down and fracturing the national whole. And then once that becomes the norm, they then turn around and say, see, the nation doesn't exist. Once they break down the sources of virtue and consensus, and chaos ensues, they then turn around and say, see, force is the only thing that matters. You guys were wrong all along. Of course, they helped create the circumstances where they can say this. And people have such short memories that they can be easily manipulated this way. You see this with technology. I don't recall any votes on the technology, the explosion of the 20th century, that has altered everyone's life. In fact, democracy doesn't seem to affect those things that affect our lives the most. Economics, technology, the so-called culture, media. No one ever voted any of these people into power. The window dressing can be voted on, and even that's very, very iffy. So the notion of this self-fulfilling prophecy, technology forcibly takes over how people relate to one another socially or antisocially, and then these same people who benefited from this will turn around and say, see, this was an inevitable development. Always be suspicious of the word inevitable, because usually they're talking about themselves or their allies. And this is how we know that the Western idea, or the liberal idea, or the modernist idea, is first of all of foreign origin. It mostly came from Great Britain, and to a lesser extent France, but it's also primarily economic. Which is strange when you consider how well Russia was doing economically at the time. You've all heard the statistics. My first book, The Third Rome, goes into painful detail as to how Russia was better off economically and financially than most other countries on the planet, at least in the West. They had the lowest taxes, smallest number of bureaucrats, extremely low crime, a very undeveloped prison system. Now, there were no prisons in Siberia. It was simply a place of exile. Most of the exiles usually found their way home. The Soviets, of course, changed that. And the concept of nominalism destroys the idea of any universal law whatsoever, so they have no choice but to talk about law as sheer force. Now, the Slavophiles certainly believed in universal, especially from a religious point of view. But they were very Hegelian, and we talked about Hegel at some length on this show. They were Hegelian in the sense that the forms, the content of natural law, isn't known in full, especially by the common population, except through national experience. An experience of both good and bad events, of good harvests and bad harvests, of foreign occupation and independence. All these twists and turns of no different than a family. That's what comes to define them as a people, because they're able to get through all of this. They have the as I've called them, the structures of survival that have been built in bad times to create the consensus and the virtue necessary to function in any time. They don't exist. Universals are real, but they have to have concomitant experience that the historical record then creates a nation. Doesn't mean it's not a universal phenomenon, but it does mean that the subjective and the objective have to go together. Mere objectivity doesn't mean anything. You have to have a reason to take it seriously at all. Nation exists as a biologic and social fact. The subjective experience is, why should I care? Why follow any of these strictures, whether formal or informal? And this is what's forgotten. And the whole Slavophile movement was the interior disposition necessary to follow any kind of laws is far more important than the laws themselves. And that's very rarely talked about in the Western world, especially by conservatives who should know better. They are not purely intersubjective. They do link up with natural law at many points. But natural law is way too vague to matter until experience fills in those blanks. Social life, culture, the nation, even the state, these are products of experience, a specific set of time and circumstances, the economy, the topology, the sort of neighborhood you're in, whether you're surrounded by enemies or surrounded by water, all of these kind of things, you know, conspire to create the nation. The same way that natural law exists and is proof of universals. Words are also archetypes. Nikolai Gogol talks about this at great length in his nonfiction work. But words, more than anything else, are products of historical experience. How many times have I said that the definitions of words in any language 200 years ago have very little bearing, sometimes could be the opposite, of those very same words uttered in the postmodern era? And I've been through the list of them, everything from love to law to justice to health to organic. These terms didn't mean the same many years ago. The people referred to only its leadership, the legitimate aristocrats, the natural aristocracy that's created by any ethnic group. And in many cases in the West, the ethnic group was so taken for granted, it was assumed that this is going to be one morality, one people, one nation, one language, that they didn't really talk about it. It was simply implied that these laws mean nothing unless there's a certain level of virtue and religious experience that people can tap into, giving them a reason to serve the public good at all. Of course, things like borrowing from other peoples is perfectly normal. You consider your own personal or family development and simply juxtapose that to the national level. I've actually heard stupid arguments that nations don't exist because ethnic groups are always borrowing one from another. Well, I don't know what's doing the borrowing, but so what? Everyone does that. It doesn't change a thing. English is a combination of at least four languages. That doesn't mean it isn't a legitimate language. But, you know, we're talking here about an era where technology was increasing rapidly. The Industrial Revolution is a bit older than this, but as far as the Russians are concerned, this is the start of the Industrial Revolution. As I said, that's the crisis that these movements are dealing with. That's the context. And the way that the Slavophiles saw, very much like the Western agrarians, technical progress, industrialization, seems to parallel superficiality and over-formalism in law and basic morals. the colonial empires that were probably at their height, maybe at this point, middle of the 19th century, maybe a little later, they weren't based on ethnicity. They were based on the denial of ethnicity. If ethnic groups and nations don't exist, as the left will have you believe, unless it's convenient for them, then neither does imperialism. Because the only problem with imperialism is that they prevent and destroy the independence of ethnic groups. So if there's no nation, there is no imperium either. No, in fact, in this period of time, colonialism, very much like today, is justified by progress. That was always a justification of the colonial expansion, especially in Britain and in the Netherlands. These are benighted noble savages who we have to slowly bring and make English gentlemen out of them, because everybody knows that the human nature is about becoming an English gentleman. Liberalism was seen as the total fulfillment of history, and that became very fashionable at the end of the Cold War, you know, the Fukuyama, et cetera, et cetera. You know, taking such limited experience and exploding it, making it the whole purpose of history as such, this shows you the immaturity of so many of these people. The war that's brewing, the deliberate war picked by the U.S. against China, which the U.S. cannot win, as I say, that's not the purpose, isn't justified by any national connection. The opposite. It's based on the idea that, oh, the poor Chinese, they live under such tyranny, and we're here to liberate them. And the minute we come walking in there, they're going to rush to our side and wave American flag. They really think that. If you recall, that's exactly what Rumsfeld said before the Iraq War many years ago. Knowledge in the true sense, and the Slavophiles are very interested in this, knowledge is embedded. What we value comes from experience, history, the history of labor. Labor itself is very situated in time and place. Liberalism, in a very broad sense, modernism, rejects all of this. The writings of Adam Smith, which are purely abstract, although maybe not as abstract as people think, can apply anywhere at any time. This is the same silly ideology that caused the almost total genocide of Russians and Ukrainians in the 1990s. Their population was shrinking as quickly as it was during any war, all based on the idea that the American liberal oligarchic system should be imposed anywhere at any time, and the people are going to thank us for it. And of course, the exact opposite was true. In Europe, meaning Western Europe, the ego was the great sin, the ego which creates the oligarchic institutions. The so-called Asian sense, the Kushites, as Komiakov would call it, that's based on the rule of Moloch, of cemented nobilities with human sacrifice at the core. The oligarchy is, in fact, conquest. It's pretense over knowledge. It's the dropping of symbols and slogans rather than actual in-depth understanding. So one way to put it is that society, and again, I'm quoting Aksakov here, society is a union in a common faith, belief, and moral idea situated in history. This work, The Principles of Russian History, the integration of all of these forces, all of these factions, is the historical mission, the Russian mission. It's what people like Yuri Krasanich would call the estate democracy, the rule of balanced classes, not classes not in terms of income, but in terms of function. Integrating them within a single historical experience is what Russian history has been based on. And if there is any political theory or form of rule or understanding of the state without love, that which is created by this union of common faith, belief, and moral idea, it is a fraud. The law doesn't create love. It presupposes it. The idea of the sobor, it's not merely a commune. It's a community where authority means a lot more than power, because the land is based on authority. The state is based on formal power. Now, Kolmogorov is probably the best known of the Slavophiles. I hinted at this a little bit when I talked about the so-called Asian versus the Western concept of oligarchy. His philosophy of history put the Kushite, now I've talked about this actually at some length before, the Kushite versus the Iranian or the Aryan. Modern writers use Iranian to avoid using the word Aryan. These are myths, and Alexei Losev goes far in talking about what the nature of a myth is. No one, that's one of these words that doesn't have its original meaning anymore. The myth, so-called, is the foundation for love. The myth is the background understanding of our life, what we intuitively and instinctively know is right and wrong. Of course, today that's been twisted beyond all recognition. But the myth is the essence beyond reason. It's the background information that we don't consciously follow, but we simply assume. The myth is the background culture, the culture in the broadest sense. In the true Iranian sense, meaning the Aryan sense, it's the sobor, the community, fixes the human will. The crown is a function of the sobor, of this very community that Russia had from top to bottom prior to the revolution. It goes so far as to say that organization, not an organism, but an organization proves that society is falling to pieces. Believe it or not, that idea says that love is an epistemological category. It's not merely this vague saccharine idea that you hear about all the time in Western countries. And that means that our will and our reason are not necessarily distinct faculties. In fact, there are no distinct faculties. Authority is something based on consensus. Power is inherently a sin. Kolmogorov's epistemology takes issue with the modernist idea that the knowledge of something is that something itself, which he says very explicitly. The truth is revealed in actions over time, not formal statements. If you want to describe a scenario using the simple day-to-day language, how much description is the language capable of? You describe going on vacation versus actually going on vacation. Well, what's the difference? That difference shows the weakness of language, the weakness of words by themselves to describe anything. There has to be something deeper than that, and that's the idea of the myth of the sobor. It's the unity of subjective and the objective. And that's your first step to actually approach reality. I use the word, you see this in Slavophile language. Faith is an intuition. And it's one of these words that just really has to love, doesn't have any meaning anymore. Faith is intuition. It's the data before it becomes conceptualized into objects and words. Faith, in fact, is something that precedes logic. In fact, logic requires it. For Kolmogorov, some of the modern ideas that, being is replaced by thought, which is pure abstraction. Reason, in the sense of logic, is completely one-sided. Now, I mentioned the Kushite and the Aryan idea. I've done an hour-long show on this 2 years ago, maybe a little bit more. You could find it in my archives. But the Kushite idea, the Asiatic and African idea, is organization over organism. It's mechanical. It's logical. It's rigid. It's stratified and statist. Punishment, magic, ritual, radical disjunction among classes. That's the Kushite idea. It's just this mechanical conception of social life based entirely on formal language. It is civilization rather than culture. It's materialism at its root, or fetishism, really. And it's monumental. Kushite societies tend to have huge, like the Egyptians or the Assyrians, massive monuments in their capital cities. The Aryan is the opposite. It's organic. It's based on logos or nous, not logic. It's poetry versus prose. Now, as I said, the Slavophile idea is that the ethnic group or the nation is organic. That proceeds, of course, from historical experience. And this is the difference between the crown and the state. That was a difference that was collapsing even in the modern era in the West prior to the revolution. The crown is, in fact, an informal idea. It's tradition. The monarch literally wears it all over him. Every square inch of those elaborate outfits and throne rooms expresses some part of experience that the nation, the royal family, has gone through. That's the difference between the Aryan and the Kushite. Is one, you know, the Aryan is a stress on organic poetry, and the Kushite is based on mechanicals, a mechanical rule, and prose, and formality. I mean, even in canon law, I mean, people still want to interpret canon law as if they're Western positivists. That's not how it was written. That's not how it's meant to be read. Words only go to, can you imagine taking the entire Orthodox faith, or the Catholic faith, and reducing it to words on a page? What would that be like? Can you be completely Orthodox just by doing nothing but reading and keeping the canons? And of course the answer is no. Not only were these canons written in very specific instances and moral crises and all the rest of it, not only was it written at times that have zero in common with our own, that's bad enough, but it's also using words. Yes, they're archetypes, but in our nominalist era, that's long gone. They're constantly changing, and that changing definition is a weapon. You know, racism and sexism are the obvious ones. I cringe every time I hear those words. They are explicitly without meaning. They're meant solely as emotional outbursts, and nothing more than that. It's the old stereotype of the Puritan yelling about witches. That's really all it is. Not an exaggeration, but it's the same idea. It's not meant to be rational. Racism, which of course the regime is based on opposing, is whatever, you know, the universities say it is. Monarchy links, and the monarchy, of course, only makes sense within the national context, and not necessarily because the monarch is of one nation. But even an empire, like the Austrian, which of course didn't work for a whole bunch of reasons, was based on the unity of nations, not the mixing of nations. And the monarch was supposed to represent this. Same thing for Yugoslavia prior to the war. The monarch wasn't merely a Serb. He was a Yugoslav. For better or for worse, that was the mentality. Now, of course, Russia had an ethnic monarchy. The Tsar was an ethnarch, because the bulk of the population was a Slav of one sort or another. And the Turks, or the Turkic Islamic groups of the south, preferred royal rule in Russia to their own Ayatollahs. Every 100 years or so, one of these guys shows up. I don't even mean Ayatollah as a pejorative. You know, I'm pretty much pro-Iranian, at least in politics. But some kind of a fanatical, usually Western-based leadership. The Wahhabis, etc. And of course, no one was mixing. They were all left alone. They had their own military units within the National Army. They had their own institutions. Only at the highest level of law were they ever affected by the crown, the state, in a different sense. The Tsar was an ethnarch for that reason. As I said, you had this hierarchy. The village, the guild, the parish / monastery, the state, and the civic life. Kominkov says its blood isn't necessarily the nation. Of course, it's at its root. But that doesn't mean anything without love or faith. Faith is the core of everything. It's often based on a unity of blood, but doesn't have to be. And Russia was proof of that fact. When ethnicity is denied, the only thing that could take its place is ego, nominalism, and the state. That's the problem. The closest we could find, well, I guess Edmund Burke, and we talked about Adam Mueller in the German Historical School of Economics a few weeks ago, and even the Hegelian movement, the right Hegelian movement. was as close as the Western world was going to get. Because of the nature of Orthodoxy, it shows up in Russia and Serbia very differently than it will in the rest of the world. Morals don't, by their structure, have force. In other words, they're not based on power, they're based on authority. Power is based on abstraction. It's based on abstract law and bureaucracy. To use a word like absolute, which is, again, one of these words that has no definition, which doesn't mean the same today as it did 200 years ago. The using that term is to completely mutilate the political understanding of the Russian crown. An absolute state is the existence of the pure Kushite ideal. Everything based on, you would say that the American empire today is a Kushite movement. You know, a form of government usually doesn't matter. The form of government is not all that relevant. It's the moral fiber of a population. When an evil government comes to power, the only thing left is your moral foundation and the ethnic group, which is what Pugachev represented in Russia. As those like Samanin and many others have stated, the state itself exists for power, but power has to rest on authority, or it's nothing, or it's strictly an alien phenomenon. There's no best form. When you talk about the moral content of the ethnic group, the state form is often irrelevant. The bureaucracy is going to function like a bureaucracy no matter what political group justifies it. I should say, whatever political organization justifies it and places it where it is. Michael Oakeshott stated that even in the 20th century, the abstract form of state doesn't have anything to do with power. It is a way to claim authority, however. Now, Samanin was a bit different from Komiakov and Aksakov because there was a best form of state. You know, they were only really concerned with Russia and the Slavic lands as being a royalist population. And their basis really is not only the Old Testament, but also Constantine and then later St. Vladimir in Kiev. This chain of organic religious models of authority, you know, I mean, even in ancient Israel, the great kings like Josiah, yeah, they didn't have massive armies of policemen and a national security administration like the modern states have. They had very little. Power was wielded at the clan level, at the family level. And I say family, I mean the extended, very large family. People like Samarin or Stamatin, formal law doesn't have meaning. That's why the sovereign, again, not a formal idea, that's why the sovereign is so important. That's why I started this lecture off by talking about Tsar Nicholas I. And it was through his example where, to some extent, the Slavophiles got their origin point. I was going to talk about St. Macarius and others. That's going to have to wait for next week. So this is going to be, I didn't realize, though, this is going to be a part one. So next week we'll do part two, the Slavophile movement. And remember, this is the foundation of everything that we do here. The Orthodox nationalist really is the Russian Orthodox nationalist. And by nationalist, it is the Slavophile movement. We'll complete this next week. Thank you, everyone, for listening, and I will talk to you next time. Bye-bye.